when I was young, I loved Robert De Niro so much. And in the movie Taxi Driver, he orders a piece of apple pie with cheese melted over the top. So for all 4 years of high school, whenever I went to Denny's, I would eat a piece of apple pie with some cheese melted over the top, because that's what he ordered when he had his date with Sybil Shepherd.
I had black coffee and apple pie with a slice of melted yellow cheese. I think that was a good selection.
I don't even like cheese over apple pie, but he was so cool, I had to eat it. Because I wanted people to ask me, what's with the cheese and the apple pie? Oh, have you seen Taxi Driver? No? You really should. Let me tell you the whole movie. So.
That was Keegan-Michael Key, best known as one half of Key and Peele on Comedy Central. We want to know, what's your pie story? Did it involve a slice of melted cheddar cheese? Does it involve competing in a pie contest? The 7th annual Good Food Pie Contest is just 5 weeks away. Mark your calendars for Sunday, October 4th. We're headed to the Fowler Museum at UCLA, and we've got an A-plus list of judges lined up for you. Sherry Yard, Roxana Julepot, Akasha Richman, and more of our favorite chefs, bakers, and food critics will be on hand to select the best pies from fruit to savory. Register now at kcrw.com/pie. And now back to the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Sometimes food's at the center of a family's story. People cook for one another, and a lot of time is spent at the table. Stories are spun, family legends are solidified, people let their hair down, which leads sometimes to hilarity and sometimes to tender confession. Los Angeles artist and photographer Orly Olivier reminds us that food and the experience of eating together can provide a powerful connection to the past. Her installation and event series, Petite Taquette, opens this Tuesday, September 1st at the Skirball. Hi.
Hello.
So tell me, what is Petite Taquette?
Petite Taquette is a project about sharing familial and religious culture through food and entertaining. I have a blog, and I host Shabbat dinners around town, and I hopefully inspire others to revitalize their family's traditions and bring them back into the focus of their own life in a way that's relevant for them.
You have quite a family food tradition, so take us back. Where's your family from?
My father was born in Tunisia, and my mother was American. My father left Tunisia in 55, to Israel, and then in 1962 came to Los Angeles. And he loved to cook and entertain. We had many, many lively Shabbat dinners and dinner parties, all surrounded by couscous and tons of kemia salads and beautiful exotic treats.
And Taquette, I understand, is the name of a restaurant.
Taquette was the name of my grandmother's restaurant in La Goulette, Tunisia, and was a nickname given to my uncle by a British soldier. He was trying to give him a piece of chocolate, and he said, "Take it, take it." And the other brothers and sisters thought that it was a nickname. And my grandmother thought it was very charming and named her restaurant Taquette.
That's so hilarious.
Pretty funny, right?
Yeah, I love that. The photographs that are on your blog and that will be in the installation are so universal in their specificness, I guess I want to say. There's this one picture that I think most people will respond to, of your dad bare-chested in the kitchen, a couple of little kids by his side, sort of just roaming around, and on a board set next to him are these huge balls of meat. I don't know, there's something about that image that's so, I don't know, it's lovely.
It's everyone's childhood, you know, whether it's your mother or your father. There's always a moment in the kitchen where there's stuff happening everywhere. And as a child, you just want to sort of be involved and want to know what's happening. And I always had a love for food and cooking. And so that little person in the photograph is me.
So what, aside from family pictures, there are household objects and some heirlooms that are included in the installation. What are some of them?
So probably the most important object is the actual physical recipe box with all the recipe cards in it. Another object is a brass grater that always hung in the kitchen and kind of looks like a turtle. And I used to suck my thumb with a stuffed turtle. So it was always like my favorite sort of kitchen object. There's also a sign that always hung in their kitchen, Cuisine Maison chez Sylvain, Home Cooking with Sylvain. And it's hung in every kitchen that I've ever had. So it's also a very special object. And lastly is a hamsa.
What is a hamsa?
A hamsa is something that is a symbol that wards off evil eye. And they hung everywhere in our house, like a mezuzah, kind of. And it's just very special to me and something that was part of my household growing up.
So what intrigues me about this particular project is that it seems like a lot of the content has been marinating inside you for a really long time.
For sure. Because of the sort of tragedy that happened, both my parents dying as a teenager, the things that are left behind are all that I have. So I've studied them for years, and as a photographer, I shot family photos, and they never really made sense. They made sense to me, but they didn't make sense to anyone else. They were just pretty pictures of people. And one day, I found the recipe box and sort of had this aha moment, and all this stuff came together. I realized that there was a theme, and it was food and dinner and sharing culture.
When you were growing up, what did Shabbat mean in your house?
Shabbat meant being together and sort of celebrating that time, and wasn't necessarily about the prayers or about a religious event. It was more just about sharing and family and food. And
what was likely to be on the table?
Always couscous. Couscous comes in many variations. Sometimes it's with chicken and vegetables. Sometimes it's a much heavier broth with meat and beans. My favorite is always the lighter broth with the boulettes. Boulettes are meatballs, those brown meaty balls you saw in the photograph, wrapped in potato or zucchini, and then they're dredged and fried. But the meatballs have mint and cilantro, parsley. They're very fragrant and absolutely delicious.
So when you found the recipe box, did you yourself sort of go through this exercise of reconnecting by making the recipes?
Absolutely. Also, they weren't really recipes.
What do you mean they weren't really recipes?
They said things like, put the potato in the pan, cook on high fire. You know, it's not a recipe. There were no increments or cooking times, or it was just a sort of a general feel of.
But I love that, okay, you just said this sentence in English, but with an accent. So you are parroting your father.
For sure. He lived in the U.S. most of his life, but he still had a pretty thick accent and I think would turn it on more strongly at times when it worked in his favor. But he was also uneducated for the most part, and his writing it's in English, but it's spelled in French. It's misspelled in French. It's misspelled in English. It has an Arab translation, you know. So they're a little pigeon, but
they're essentially him.
They're totally him, and that was the thing that when I opened the box and looked at them as an adult, I could hear him talking on the phone with my grandmother long distance, you know, and I could see the box in the kitchen, and it really, these cards personify his journey as an immigrant and how he maintained his cultural identity.
It's been wonderful to have this opportunity to sit with you, Orly. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Orly Olivier. Her installation, Petite Taquette, opens at the Skirball this Tuesday, September 1st. We have a recipe for her harissa, two ways, on the Good Food blog. Make it, and I guarantee you'll be slathering it on everything. Coming up, the Jewish delicatessen. One deli man likens it to the town country club, with free membership and pickles, of course. Stay close.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Welcome back to Good Food. In the 1930s, the Jewish deli was a thriving institution with 1,500 kosher delis in the five boroughs of New York alone. Now, there are just a fraction left, 150 across all of North America. And yet, there are still a few third-generation men and women cutting the pastrami and making the stuffed cabbage. David Ziggy Gruber is one of them. He's a larger-than-life ubermensch on a mission to keep tradition alive one plate at a time. His deli, Kenny and Ziggy's, is in Houston, and he's featured in the new documentary, Deli Man. Hi, Ziggy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so glad to talk to you. What a fantastic movie.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I mean, I really, truly, truly appreciate it.
What's your earliest memory of the family business?
The earliest memory of the family business I have probably would be my mother pushing me in a carriage to visit my grandparents every day at the store. So I remember that early, and then naturally as I got older, we would be hanging out in the store, and by the time I was about 8 years old, my grandfather looked at me and threw an apron at me, and he said, "It's time to make a living," and basically brought me into the kitchen and started teaching me how to cook. I just love the warmth of being around family, that it really, really, truly made it such a loving experience for me that it's something that I just really enjoyed, and I couldn't think of me doing anything else.
You know, what fascinates me is when we talk about the period of time that there were these 1,500 kosher delis just in the New York boroughs alone, we're talking about an institution that was really neighborhood-based. And now it seems that delis are much bigger and they're destinations. Who comes to your Houston deli? Do you have a large Jewish population, or does it go beyond that?
First of all, Houston has a large Jewish population. We're the largest in Texas. That's number one. Number two, it does go beyond that. What happened is when we first opened up the store, 70% of my business was all Jewish business. Today, it's reversed. It's like 30% is Jewish, and the rest is non-Jewish. It's not that we lost the 70%. What happened is that people have come in here, tried the food, enjoyed it, and our business has grown. So you're right that to say that things were neighborhood-based back then, because you're right, every neighborhood had their own delicatessen store. And today, because of attrition, these stores are a lot larger, the ones that are left. The one thing today, though, which you're finding is nobody can build these big stores today, which is kind of a shame because they can't pay the rents and the overhead. But the one thing about our store is it's really become the center of not just the Jewish community, of the whole community of Houston. I mean, all the politicos come here, and all of the local celebrities, and all of the movers and shakers in town here like to eat here and like to see and be seen. It's like a country club, you know, with free membership and pickles.
Yeah, there's the whole schmooze part of the deli.
Right.
So you didn't just have this seamless entry from apprenticing in your family deli and starting. You actually went off to culinary school. Did you do that knowing you would come back to the deli?
Well, you know, back then, I always wanted to be in the delicatessen business all my life. And I was very close with my grandfather. And when my grandfather passed away, and I was 15 years old, I took it very bad. And I told one of my cousins, because at 16, you didn't have to go to school anymore. I said, "You and I, we're going to go and we're going to get a store, a small store, and we're going to build it up and we're going to start." And that was the plan. And my mom, as all Jewish parents, it's all about education, education, education. She said, look, I'm going to take you to England and I'm going to introduce you to cousins and get your mind off of things, and then we'll figure it all out. So I go to England not knowing any of my cousins, and I meet this one cousin, and he informs me that he is going to culinary school. I said, you're going to culinary school? If you're going, I'm going too. So I went, and I went to this thing, and I made a deal with the headmaster, and then I started. And I went, and I did very well in culinary school. I was recruited by the Roux brothers at Le Gavroche. It was a wonderful experience. When I came back to New York, I did a couple of small stints at Gotham Bar and Grill and also at a place called Aurora. Then I went back to the Le Gavroche. And then one day I came back to the United States, and I went to with my dad to the Deli Man's Association dinner. And when I went there, I looked around the room, and I saw all these people, 70, 80 years old. And I said, who's going to perpetuate this food? So I decided then and there that that was my calling and that's what I was going to do. And I told my dad and my uncle, I said, you know what, I'm going back into the business with you guys. You guys are getting older, and we're just going to take this to another level. And that was it.
So when you say take it to another level, did you play a little bit with any kind of deli fusion with this newfound background that you had in fine dining?
Well, you know, I this is the thing. I'm a traditionalist in any of my cooking. I think it's got to be honest. When people do fusion, some people are doing it just for the sake of being cute. And I don't think that necessarily works. You know, when I make goulash, it's not a fusion. It tastes like goulash, and it is honest, and it is what it is. Do I use other techniques that might make it lighter or have a little bit more flavor? Yes, that's from my culinary background. Are my blintzes lighter than what blintzes are, and they're crunchy and they're light and they have this wonderful flavor? Yes, that's from that. But they are strictly blintzes. It's not like I'm adding wasabi to my blintzes and turning it into some kind of hazari that no one's going to even know.
There's a scene in the film of you slicing fish. Can you explain a European-style cut of fish and how it contributes to taste?
Sure. A lot of people do what I call a V-cut, like they will go to the right side and slice down and to the left side, and it looks like a V when they're slicing it. Or they'll just do straight down on a bias. We do it from head to tail. What this does, it's a lot more skill in it, but it gives it a silkier consistency. It gives it this luxurious, I can't explain it, on your tongue. It's a real machai, it's a real pleasure to eat such Nova. And when you taste our Nova, and I ship a lot of Nova to people in L.A., it's funny, because they're old customers of mine, and they can't find Nova that's cut like that. It's not that my product that I get is any better than what someone else is using. It's how I handle that product. There are very few appetizing stores, you know, that do it. There's us. I think Russ and Daughters does it well. Barney Greengrass, a place like Zabar's. But besides that, I don't know of too many people that had those artisan type of people. And as time goes on, what you see in a lot of delicatessen stores are they're running on autopilot, and a lot of people just don't know, so they can't train the next generation of counter people how to do that.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Be well and azai gesund.
Same to you. Ziggy Gruber owns Kenny and Ziggy's in Houston. He's also featured in the documentary film Deli Man. Here in L.A., one of our modern deli men is Micah Wexler. But before he opened Wexler's Deli at the Grand Central Market, Micah did a series of historical dinners. In each one, he'd investigate a slice of L.A. history. The series was called To Live and Dine in L.A., and it was the inspirational name for Josh Kuhn's historical book and exhibition of L.A. menus at the Central Library in downtown L.A. I've got both Josh and Micah in the studio with me now. So, Josh.
Yes.
Had you gone to some of Micah's dinners?
No, I hadn't. But first, I want to say that I need to thank Micah because my I think of my body as being like, you know, there's like pre-Wexler's Deli Josh and post-Wexler's Deli Josh. No, I'd never been.
You have the six pack now, right?
Right. I'd never been to any of those dinners, and when we first met to talk about him being one of the chefs involved in remixing menus for the book, we had that title conversation, and immediately I was like, can I have that title? That's the better than anything. I had sourced like every title. I thought I was so clever and I couldn't come up with anything. But the best part was that both of us, I think, thought of the title as an homage to Tupac. So we took it from the Tupac song. And then everybody else, when I told the title to, was like, oh, from the William Friedkin movie. That's genius. And I was like, oh, no, not at all, actually. No, this is two white Jewish boys. This is about Tupac.
We had the same thing the first night that we did the dinner that, you know, people were asking us, oh, from the movie. And I was like, what movie? I had never even heard of the movie. It's like, no, Tupac. What are you guys talking about, you know?
Yeah, for me, it was the movie.
Yeah.
A generational thing. When did you decide to bring contemporary chefs in and have them take a look at the archive and sort of do their spin?
One of the things when I do these projects is I'm very clear with myself about what I don't know. And the first thing I did actually was bring a chef in, Roy Choi, to look through the menu collection with me. And he really helped shape the way the whole project happened and the book happened. And then like with the sheet music book, I gave old songs to contemporary musicians to record them and find new stories in them in ways that only a musician could. And in the same way, I wanted chefs to look at these menus and see things that there's no way that I could see. I was just blessed that all these incredible chefs from across the city agreed to come in and say, yeah, I want to rethink these menus.
Did you assign them or did they choose?
I gave selections. You know, most chefs, the idea, if you said to them, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead and do your own search through 13,000 menus. That's pretty much a guarantee you're not getting an email back. So I gave like about five menus each that I tried to pick based on either elements of a chef's biography, a cuisine that a chef was known for, part of the city, like with Susan Fenninger, for example. The one that she ended up choosing, which is the one I hope she would have picked, was for the Angel's Flight restaurant, which was just too perfect in terms of her relationship to that particular corridor, which also could have worked for you as well, Grand Central Market.
So, Micah, when you were given your selection, which menu did you pick?
I chose the Albert Einstein dinner at the Ambassador Hotel. And out of the menus that Josh sent me, there was a couple reasons why it stood out. One, when I was a kid, I think I was maybe in third grade or something, and, you know, you're getting assigned the book report. And I read a book on Albert Einstein. And ever since then, I've always sort of had this affinity for him. And so that jumped out at me right away. And then, you know, the Ambassador Hotel to me is so the quintessential story of this whole book in a lot of ways because it had such history and so many important things happened there and was a real cultural destination for a lot of people in Los Angeles for a long time. So kind of those two worlds coming together was, it, you know, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, I don't even need to look at the other menus. It's the one.
What year is it from?
1931, actually.
And it's sort of this extraordinary document because it's a private dinner, a private banquet honoring him. And the image on the front is this kind of dour black and white picture of Mr. and Mrs. Einstein.
Yeah, which is almost very of the time also. You know, it's sort of those, you look at that photography of that time and everybody's always got this either angry or puzzled look on their face.
It almost looks Photoshopped to me because she looks mildly happy,
yeah.
You know, and he looks like it's like a mugshot.
Yeah.
It's like it's like a DP camp photo, you know.
He's got the classic hair. I mean, it's just right on.
And then there's a program, of course, and so many of the people who are participating in the program are rabbis of the city. And there's a violin solo.
Yeah, I mean, it had to be a hell of a dinner to be at.
Yeah,
it
was wonderful dinner. Great time. So give me a couple of highlights that made you really excited. And did you actually make them, or is this just a purely intellectual exercise?
I mean, it's mostly intellectual, but there are elements of the dishes that I came up with that, you know, I've made in the past or that have been inspired by other things. But, you know, one of the things that really intrigued me about this menu and is something Josh and I have talked about a bunch and is really emblematic of menus of this time is you get these dishes with names that are totally nondescriptive and that you could never really figure out, okay, what is this about? For example, half spring chicken saute ambassador. Okay, you know what I mean? Fresh fruit supreme California, which was probably made with canned oranges anyhow. And so to jump into these things and try and research and figure out what did a chicken saute ambassador actually look like, what kind of ingredients did it have in it, is sort of like part of the detective work and the challenge of figuring this out.
Okay, one of my favorite of the menu items is the very beginning, hearts of celery and ripe olives. And yeah. I have to say that I'm old enough that I actually remember going to restaurants or going to fancy dinners at friends' house where you would have like the relish tray.
Right.
It wasn't crudité. It was just a relish tray with celery and the kind of olives that if you were a child, you would stick on your fingers.
Yeah. I still do that. Is that bad?
Too.
So what did you turn that dish into?
You know, it was interesting because I also have some memories of that. I mean, my grandmother used to do that in her own way. You know, there'd be like some sauerkraut, some olives, some pickles, that sort of thing. And so when I saw that, there was some familiarity with that. And, you know, then, of course, there's this thing of the olive that jumped out to me right away, right? It was no secret that Albert Einstein was a big Zionist and, you know, the olive branch being the sign of peace and, you know, really Zionism in a big way too. I was like, I got to figure out some sort of play on that. And so the idea there was to stuff the olives with what we call like a piperata, you know, kind of a Spanish chopped, usually ham and peppers, but this would be with celery instead. And of course, you know, in my typical fashion, sort of poking fun at it a little bit too. It's something inspired by Zionism, but has ham in it. And the idea was that those would be sort of breaded and fried and stuck back onto an olive branch, and you would receive the olive branch as the actual dish and be able to kind of pluck the olives right off and eat them.
I love this so much because, you know, this is a combination of just the geekiest, most marvelous social history seen through the lens of how chefs' minds work. And those two things together are just such a gift. So thank you, Josh Kuhn, for creating this for all of us.
Thank you, Evan.
I look forward to many more conversations of this kind. And thank you so much, Micah.
I love being here, as always.
That was Michael Wexler, chef, owner of Wexler's in Grand Central Market, and Josh Kuhn, the author of To Live and Dine in L.A. Jonathan Gold's in the studio in 1 minute. It's Jumbo Shrimp and Cocktail Sauce next.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is here with his weekly restaurant review. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and we look forward to his visit every week here on Good Food. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
What do you have for us today?
Well, we're going to Catch and Release in Marina Del Rey.
And who's behind this new venture?
It is owned, as are two-thirds of the ambitious restaurants in town, by Bill Chait. And the chef is Jason Neroni, who I think we last talked about when he was at Superba in Venice.
So what is on the menu at Catch and Release? It sounds like it's a fish place.
And you would be correct.
I guess that makes sense for Marina Del Rey.
Yeah. It's sort of New England-style seafood, but modified a little bit. So you will find a raw bar, and you will find peel in each shrimp. The cocktail sauce is spiked with sriracha in this case. The starters include – actually, this is odd. They have what they call and what pretty much are Hojo-style clam strips. Do you remember those at the old Howard Johnson's?
The ones that are like rubber bands.
Yeah, pretty much exactly like rubber band. When we used to go to Disneyland as kids, I mean, a highlight of Disneyland was always going to the Howard Johnson's afterwards and having those clam strips.
So are these clam strips less like rubber bands?
Yes, they're more clammy, less rubber bandy. And the funny thing about it is that the flavor of the seasoning and the breading was less what I remember from Howard Johnson's and more like some distant yet fond childhood memory of the Mojo potatoes at Shakey's.
You're so funny. I'm sure that isn't what Jason Neroni is working towards.
I am sure Jason Neroni has never even heard of a Mojo potato. yet that's what his particular spice blend resembles. And it has there's a little Old Bay in it, and there's obviously like a really delicious tartar sauce. And it's for anybody who grew up in LA, you are going to feel the same sort of waves of nostalgia when you taste this particular dish as somebody in New England might.
Interesting.
Some other things that I liked there were a cod chowder with, you know, lots of chunked up Nusky's bacon. Really, you can't really mess with Nusky's bacon. There are the same sort of Parker House rolls, like crisp crusted, really sort of airy and soft that you might have had at Connie and Ted's up in West Hollywood. This the same sort of saltiness, the same sort of, you know, buttery thing going on.
Is the menu changeable, or is it a lot of it in the form of specials?
There don't seem to be that many specials, or there do. There's always something, but it's always pretty much the same. So you're always going to find, you know, a clam bake with, you know, clams and lobster broth and a little bit of lobster, corn, potatoes. It's always going to be like spicy in almost the same way. You're always going to find like a fish and chips. I mean, someday it'll be regular cod, someday it'll be ling cod. The actual fish itself changes around. I mean, maybe you'll find a striped bass one day, and maybe another day it'll be, you know, a kind of trout, but it'll still probably come with a sort of sweet corn puree.
Give us a taste of the room itself. It's a large restaurant?
The restaurant is big. It's very open. There's an open kitchen. It feels slightly corporate probably because that's just, you know, where it is. You're in one mall staring across the street into another mall.
And they must have a pretty great cocktail program.
They have cocktails. They're done well enough, but it doesn't seem to be a huge emphasis. They have a small but appropriate, you know, wine list. And all the craft beers one would expect. You might not go to a seafood restaurant like dreaming of the dessert that you're going to have. But they do a very nice slab pie with good farmer's market peaches.
Mm.
Nothing wrong with a slab pie.
Nothing wrong with a slab pie. Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Catch and Release in Marina Del Rey. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Let's go back in time to the year 2000. The TV show Survivor was in its first season. Beyoncé, she was still a part of Destiny's Child, and it was the year of the hanging Chad and a custody battle of Elian Gonzalez. And in LA, a young chef left a career in fine dining to take over a tiny craft beer bar in Santa Monica. It's a story we hear with more frequency these days. Young chef leaves restaurant to pursue personal expression. But when Sang Yoon did it 15 years ago, people thought he was nuts. The owner of Father's Office is with me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Nuts, I guess.
Well, I think you proved to everyone how not nuts you were. there has to be a patient zero, and I think you were it. So let's get the burger out of the way. Ironically, you didn't really open Father's Office to create an iconic burger, but you ended up doing that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's always, you know, nice accidents that happen. It was just, it's so funny. Elian Gonzalez, really? Oh, wow. It was a long time ago. I wanted to express the bar culture of Europe, the bar culture that I engaged in when I was living in Europe. And I just felt like there was something missing here. We had pretty good food here, great ingredients. The idea of casual and something inspired, interesting. I just felt like it actually took a trip to Spain in the year 99 that made me realize or reconnect with the tapas bar culture in southern Spain that just kind of just clicked. And I said, that's what Father's Office looks like to me, is an Andalusian tapas bar. It's close to the water. It's just kind of like fit for me.
So we have you to blame for the small plates we've endured for the last 15 years.
Okay, you're going to put that on me too. Okay.
I remember years ago when we first met and started talking, you shared with me this template that you had created of all the parts of a burger.
Yeah, I remember that. The burger really started with a core inspiration of French onion soup. That was sort of the muse to the whole thing, is that here's this dish that I love so much. And when I broke it down, I sort of overlaid it over that template you're talking about. It all made sense. French onion soup had a bread component, a cheese component, the beef, the onions. It was all there. And I just had to sort of understand how to, you know, confine that into a sandwich.
Which you did, using beef that was very particularly sourced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we still work hard at that. The whole dry aging thing was just a whim, but it's literally become, the identity of that thing.
And a particular fat to meat ratio.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a scientific basis for that.
Which is?
Well, if you're going to use a grill, you have to have enough fat to withstand the fat dripping away. A lot of fat is lost, so it sounds like a lot. You're using 20, 22% fat. It sounds like a lot of fat, but once, if you're using a charbroiler, a grill, you lose a lot of that just in the cooking.
And then we get to the onions, this compote.
Mm-hmm. There's the French onion soup.
How many onions do you go through a day now?
Oh, we have to cook. Well, we cook 200-pound batches at a time, and we do that, I don't know, 5-6 times a week. It's its own job.
Wow. Yeah. That's just so insane. Do you serve onion soup ever?
No, I've never served onion soup, actually. Maybe I should start. We have enough onions.
You have all the ingredients.
Yeah, we do, actually. Yeah.
And then the other thing which you did, I don't know, knowingly or unknowingly, was become sort of the modification Nazi.
You know, people still talk about that, the no ketchup thing. It's I didn't think it was a big deal. I wasn't cooking in a restaurant. I had taken over a little bar, and my intention was never to be a restaurant or to act like one. You know, when you walk into a restaurant of a certain caliber, there's an expectation of a certain level of hospitality, and, you can kind of get your way in a lot of restaurants. And because I was doing something so small, I just didn't feel it was necessary.
And now, because you did that in a lot of fine dining restaurants that espouse a lot of hospitality, you can't get your way in some very small ways.
And you're going to put that on me too, right?
I'm not putting it on you because I understand why you did what you did. But you created a conversation that still goes on today about this tension between the chef who has a vision and has put a lot of time and energy into creating something very precise and particular. And the customer.
Yeah, I mean, and now in Los Angeles especially, there are so many great dining choices. And really, that conversation was for me about the choices that each side has. As a chef, you should be able to exercise and express your choices and your point of view. And as a diner, you should have your choices where, you want to dine. And, it's a matter of matching, likes and dislikes. And, given this the tininess, that my first restaurant, it was a phone booth. There was just no way to accommodate everything and everyone. And it was just like, okay, I give up. It was almost like a surrender.
And the servers were bartenders who were also like teaching classes on what craft beer was.
Yeah, that was a very different time. I mean, now we actually have breweries in Los Angeles. I mean, what a revolution just Los Angeles had with has had with beer, and that's been exciting. I remember, you know, when I first met you, beer was a very new thing to talk about. And now I love that it's just part of our landscape and where LA is actually a place to get good beer.
Okay, so you started in this really tiny space, and I would imagine also that must have been like you thinking to yourself, okay, I'm leaving this world of fine dining and I'm putting my toe in something very different. And this is a very tiny space. It's a small risk for me. Now 15 years have passed and the food scene in LA has transformed totally. I would just love to hear your opinion about what you've seen happen that you think is wonderful and what you see happening that you wish would go in a different direction.
Well, yes, Los Angeles has definitely had a renaissance. And when every time I'm asked about the food scene as it is currently, I think about how it happened. And the thing that always kind of comes up for me is 9/11. And I'd just been open a year or so, and I remember that day for all of its emotional impact. But what I noticed soon thereafter was the desire for people to want to be close in public settings. And I never saw that before. And, you know, to me, fine dining always meant privacy and space and quiet.
So you mean close like proximate?
Yeah, close in proximity, yeah. And the other thing I noticed was people seeking comfort in their dining experiences. I'd never seen macaroni and cheese on a restaurant menu before, prior to that. And I noticed that people were serving more comfort food. And maybe it was the emotional toll. I don't know. I can't explain it. But what I did notice is restaurants started opening that were smaller with communal tables, smaller plates, things to share. I mean, how else can you explain it? It's too big. I don't think you can attribute it to a person or a restaurant, but an ideology that says, this is what dining can mean. Let's dine together.
Do you have any idea how many burgers you've sold, kind of like McDonald's?
Nowhere near a billion.
But?
Not even close. Yeah. If I had to put up a sign, that's what it would say.
Sang, thank you so much.
Always my pleasure.
That was Sang Yoon, owner of Father's Office, and Lakshan. Father's Office is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. Need ideas for how to preserve all that late summer fruit? I've got some ideas for you next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. There are certain tectonic shifts around food, and one of the biggest nationwide is the interest in all kinds of preservation techniques that started several years ago. Locally, Ernie Miller, chef, historian, and co-leader of Slow Food LA, was one of the first to learn the craft and start passing on the knowledge. Hi, Ernie.
Howdy, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. So you were part of that first group that went through the Master Preserver Program.
Actually, I helped start the Master Food Preserver Program in L.A. County. I actually got my certification as a Master Food Preserver in San Bernardino County in 2009. And in the spring of 2011, I was the lead instructor for the first Master Food Preserver Program here in L.A. County in more than 14 years.
And how many Master Preservers did the program turn out?
About 60 total.
And part of the program is that you have to pass on the knowledge.
Absolutely. The key ingredient to the program is that we're looking for volunteers, people who will learn food preservation and then go out into the community and teach safe home food preservation.
But if somebody wanted to do it now, there's a kind of a giant impediment.
Unfortunately, absolutely. The Master Food Preserver Program has been indefinitely suspended as of June 30th of this year.
I find this so ironic because it's sort of like on the heels of the cottage law being passed, the law that allows people to make certain very
very particular kinds of foods in their own home and get their home inspected by the health inspector so they can actually sell the food to the public. Sort of right on the heels of that being allowed, now this sort of major source of how to do things healthfully and well is gone.
Absolutely. It's very unfortunate. Demand for this information has never been higher. And indeed, also, we see that, for example, just this year alone, there's been a couple of botulism outbreaks related to home canning because people weren't doing it properly. So not only do we teach people how to do it for their friends and family and maybe even for small business, but to do it safely so they don't actually harm people.
Yeah, that's kind of key. Is it a financial reason that the county no longer has the funds to keep it going?
Well, it's related. It's a personnel reason. We lost our county director for this program, took another job in another state, and due to the bureaucracy of the University of California system, it will be at least 2 to 3 years before we get a replacement. And it's not certain that that replacement will have authority to restart the program, even if that were to occur.
Why is this program seated in a college? What is the relationship?
Well, it's actually the whole purpose of our land-grant universities, in particular our agricultural universities like UC Davis. And so the idea is that we have a University of California cooperative extension in every county in California, and they're supposed to take the scientific-based knowledge developed at the land-grant universities and then spread it to the public. And so that's why the program was associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, the extension offices often work with farmers in more rural counties.
Oh, absolutely. Also, it's the home of 4-H. It's the home of our Master Gardener program. In these drought-related times, water conservation has become an important aspect, as well as urban agriculture, which is increasingly important here in Los Angeles.
Will a public outcry to bring it back help at all?
Unlikely. Again, it's bureaucracy, it's funding. We've had severe cutbacks to the University of California budget system, so it's difficult to get people replaced.
Wow, sad. However, there are still opportunities to learn, and one of the biggest now is situated within the nonprofit Food Forward.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm fantastically happy to be associated with Food Forward, one of the leading organizations that rescues, you know, fresh produce and then distributes it to where it's needed. They've rescued in their, you know, few years more than 12 million pounds of produce.
It really has been a startling success story. So I understand that they have a preserving program called Can It Academy.
Absolutely. It's a 12-week program. We're going to cover all the major food preservation techniques. So acid-based canning, the makings of jams, jellies, and other sweet preserves, the making of pickles, both fermented and with vinegar, and then how to process them. Pressure canning, which I call the most important type of canning, so you can can beans and soups and meats and things of that nature. Bread baking, charcuterie, cheese making, and other dairy preservation, making of yogurts and ice creams. And then we'll be covering dehydration, which people think of as just, oh, dried fruit, big deal. But there's a lot more to it than then. It can be used in amazing ways. But then we also give a professional spin to it, in-depth knowledge about AB 1616, the cottage food law that you had mentioned earlier, so that people can start their own businesses and graduates of Can It have.
It's interesting. It's sort of if you have the pipe dream of becoming a homesteader one day, this can move you from having it just be a pipe dream to giving you some real knowledge.
Absolutely. Ideal for homesteaders. Preppers will get something out of it as well, if there's any out there who are interested. But there's a lot of knowledge, and making your own food from scratch, at least knowing how to do it, the basics, is empowering.
Are there any other resources available for people learning to really take on preserving as a craft and learning the proper way?
Absolutely. As co-leader of Slow Food Los Angeles, we're going to be starting our own group of volunteers who will teach safe food preservation techniques that will be launching this fall. And we're calling them Slow Food Preservation Advisors. And they will go out into the community to places like the Santa Monica Farmers Market, to churches in Whittier, open to the public, and will give free classes or very low priced classes in safe food preservation techniques so that people can continue to learn.
Thank you so much, Ernie.
It's my pleasure.
Ernie Miller is a chef, historian, and the co-leader of Slow Food LA. He's also the lead teacher at Food Forward's Canada Academy. The 12-week preserving course begins September 14th. We've got a link with more details on our website. And now let's turn to Laura Avery, market manager at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's there now with her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the market report. I'm talking now with Ari Tamor, who is a co-owner and chef at Alma in downtown LA. And Ari, on your cart, you had a box of passion fruit. That is something that a lot of people can't even identify. Tell us what you're going to be making with it.
We do a couple things. Those passion fruits are from Laura at JJ Loan, and they're the best at the market. They're always perfectly ripe. It's pretty mind-blowing. So we're going to do them on a dessert. It's frozen yogurt, celery root, and passion fruit. And then we also make a soda with them as well.
And let's describe what they look like, and then how can you tell if they're ripe?
So they're little, they're red, kind of auburn with some yellow tinges. And when they're getting really ripe, they're very puckered and soft. But they're also, depending on what variety, they'll be ripe a little bit before that, too.
And the skin is like leather, so there's no squeezing or smelling, really, to tell if they're ripe?
No, it's really going off the farmer and kind of which what they're saying about their fruit, which variety is, whether that's ripe or not. But it's they're going to be soft and, you know, more often than not, they're pretty consistent.
And then when you cut them open inside, basically, you're getting a bunch of seeds and orange connective tissue. So it's a really kind of a bizarre looking interior too.
Yeah, it's almost like a fully built custard. So you just kind of scoop it out, which is exactly what we do with it. There's really nothing else to do. It's the texture, the everything, the flavor. It's to be left alone.
Yeah, and then the seeds too, they're so crunchy. Do you leave those in or take them out?
Yeah, I leave those in. I think the texture is really nice. It imparts a little bit of bitterness, and it's just it's a more fun texture.
Cooked raw, I mean, how do they wind up on the plate?
So the whole dessert, we have a little scoop of frozen yogurt, and then we do a celery root mousse on top, and then little bits of scooped out passion fruit and celery root chips.
I know that a little bit of passion fruit goes a long way as far as flavoring stuff, so how are you using it in other dishes?
So we're doing a soda with it where we'll use kind of like a condensed passion fruit syrup with a little bit of water and then either some champagne or rice wine vinegar, and we carbonate that.
Okay, and I've had it here at the market, just added to a fresh orange juice, and that's just fantastic.
Yeah, they do it at Pine and Crane in green tea, and it's really killer.
Okay, so passion fruit's around, and I guess can you buy smooth passion fruit and just let it sort of ripen and pucker at home?
Yeah, I think it's similar to an avocado. Would you just put it into a brown bag and leave it out until it softens?
Okay, all right, great. Well, good to know, and thanks for the tip about Laura's passion fruit.
Thank you very much.
That was Ari Tamor, and he's the chef co-owner of Alma Restaurant, really enjoying the seasonal passion fruit right now. Another seasonal variety that's just coming into the market are the dates. And you can tell that it's beginning of the season when the Barhi dates come in on the green stalks with the bright yellow dates. Now, these are hard, crunchy dates that will eventually get soft. It's one of the few varieties that is brought in this form. The market is festooned now with these beautiful sprays of bright yellow dates. And I'm talking with Annette Remter, who works with Duval Date Garden. She has a gorgeous display. The dates come in not only crunchy yellow, but in various stages of softening. So tell us a little bit about how you pick them, when you pick them, and then how we can ripen them and taste them for ourselves.
Now, dates get picked usually yellow. The Barhi date is a variety that gets picked yellow because they're actually sweet. They're a little tart. You can slice them in a salad. You can look at them. You can talk to them. You can cuddle with them. They like that. Or you can watch them mature either on the vine, or we also serve them in a basket or so. The softer they get, the sweeter they become because they break down the sugar. And then they become more perishable and fragile. And then you definitely need to put them in the refrigerator. Once they have broken down and are really soft, like butter, not butter, butter, they taste like butterscotch or caramel. And that's the sweetest variety we have. Other varieties, like the honey date we have, they cannot be eaten yellow, crunchy, because they're actually very chalky. And we don't sell them like this. When they are half crunchy, half soft, then you can actually eat them, and some customers like them a lot. There are other varieties that we have that we actually don't sell yellow because they're bitter. That is the medjool. So you have to wait till they have fully matured.
When they actually look like a date. And what's so much fun about the Barhis is they don't really look like a date yet. And when I taste them, I enjoy, they almost have a coconutty flavor.
That is interesting. A lot of customers think they're like apples or persimmons or an Asian pear. Coconut is different. Nobody said that before.
So when I get these home, I can lay them on the counter. They'll kind of ripen one by one. I can kind of pick off one a day. And then at what point would I want to put them in the fridge?
It depends how you like them. If you want them to stay crunchy longer, which some customers do, keep them uncovered in the refrigerator. On the counter, they will mature faster. And we noticed when they picked them last Friday and we had the super hot weekend, they started maturing already, which is somewhat unusual. It's the weather. So if you want them to mature a little bit, leave them on the counter uncovered. Once you can pull them off the vine or they're half crunchy, half soft, they should go in the refrigerator because you don't want them to get cranky. Cranky means they can ferment, they can become a little sour. You can eat them, it's not going to hurt you, but the flavor changes a bit. Here's one thing you can do if you really want to speed up the process and have them become soft really fast. Freeze them and then defrost them. But be aware, they are more perishable, they're more sensitive. You can let them mature completely and then refreeze them because then they won't actually freeze solid because then the sugar has fully developed and you can eat them straight from the freezer.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Okay. And they will be slowly getting riper and softer throughout the season. So this first month is probably the best time to get them in this yellow state.
First month, careful. There is only 1 month per year, middle of August to middle of September, because they're starting to mature. And if you want them, get them now, folks, because next month they were all going to be grown up.
Okay, Annette. Okay, thank you. I love this time of year when the dates come out. Thanks so much. That was Annette Remter. She is with Duval Date Garden. She's at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica Markets and with these wonderful fresh barhis, which, by the way, the other date farmers are bringing in as well. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Over Labor Day weekend, Ari Tamor will be at Field to Fork. It's part of the LA Times taste event at Paramount Studios Backlot. Russ Parsons will moderate a discussion on Root to Stem cooking with Ari, Gary Menes of Le Comptoir, and Bruce Kalman of Union. They've got events all weekend long, including two nights hosted by Jonathan Gold. We've got a link to the event on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you miss any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food On Demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.